This audio file is a production of the University of Chicago Law School. Visit us on the web at www.law.uchicago.edu.
As Elmery mentioned, the conventional wisdom is that contract law is strict liability, which is certainly what I've always told my students. And I'm teaching contracts now, and I've begun to wonder why I'm still telling my students this. Now, most of the work in law and economics has taken strict liability for granted. George Cohen's is an important exception to this point. But most of it has taken strict liability for granted and is focused on damages rules. And what I want to do is use the models that people have used to analyze damages rules and show that you can use the same type of model to show that a negligence rule could be just as good or maybe better than a strict liability rule. The model will be very familiar to many people in the room because it's just people have been using it for at least 20 years. But some of you will not have heard of it, so I'm going to go through it very quickly. It's a very simplified version of events that might give rise to a breach. So we imagine that there's a seller and a buyer. The buyer values the good at some amount, V. And the seller, when he makes the contract, he knows that with some probability it will cost him a lot to produce the good, and with some probability it will cost him very little to produce the good. And the seller, prior to performance, but after the contract is entered into, has the choice to make an investment of some sort to increase the probability that the good state of the world, as they say, will occur. In other words, that the cost of producing the good will be low rather than high. And we'll just generally assume that if the cost is low, then performance is efficient. That is, the buyer's valuation is higher than the seller's cost, and if the cost is high, performance is inefficient. The buyer's valuation is less than the seller's cost. So the timing is just, first the contract is made, then the buyer pays. You can do this in lots of different ways. The seller invests or not, and then the seller's cost is determined. And if the seller makes the investment, increases the chance that the cost of performance is low. Then the seller decides whether to perform or breach, and if the seller breaches, the seller has to pay damages. Now, in the law and economics literature, people have made the following argument. And the literature has gotten almost overwhelmingly complicated because there's so many margins of behavior that you might care about. But let's just take two. First of all, the perform or breach decision. Normatively, we might say that we want the seller to perform if and only if the seller's cost is less than the buyer's valuation. And also, with respect to the investment decision, we want the seller to make an efficient investment. That is, we want the seller to invest so that we want the seller to invest so as to reduce the probability that cost is high. But you don't want to overinvest. You don't want to underinvest. You want to make just the right investment so as to essentially ensure that the best chance that performance will be efficient. So one of the famous arguments in the literature is that expectation damages performs these functions of ensuring both efficient breach and efficient investment. The efficient breach idea is very simple. All that happens is that because the seller has to pay the buyer's valuation, the seller is only going to breach if her cost is higher than the buyer's valuation. A slightly more complicated point about investment as well, but basically the point is because the seller, in essence, as a result of the expectation damages rule, internalized the buyer's valuation as well as the seller's own cost, when the seller is making the investment in advance, the seller is going to take into account everybody's well-being, both sides' well-being, when determining what investment to make, and will therefore make the optimal investment. By contrast, other damages rules, like punitive damages, that will result in the seller breaching too little and probably investing too much, and damages rules that are too low will result in the seller breaching too often and probably investing too little. Okay, so that's the conventional analysis, and then let's now turn to fault. Well, first we have to define what fault means, and I guess a lot of this conference will be about just this question. But one can, what I do is I simply import the definition of fault roughly from the tort literature. So let me make the following definitions. A willful breach occurs when the seller breaches and the seller's cost is less than the buyer's valuation. A negligent breach occurs when the seller's cost is more than the buyer's valuation, but the seller could have made an investment, a cost-justified investment, that would have reduced her cost below the buyer's valuation, but did not. And a breach is inadvertent when the seller could not have taken a cost-justified precaution to produce the outcome where her cost is less than the buyer's valuation. So the more intuitive way of putting it would just be, there's the situation where the buyer clearly values performance more than it costs the seller to produce. If the seller goes ahead and breaches, that's willful. But then there's the more complicated situation where the buyer's valuation is less than the seller's cost, so that performance would be inefficient. But we can still, at this point, go back one step and ask, could the seller have taken precautions in order to prevent that outcome from happening? If the seller had been able to take cost-justified precautions so that her cost would actually have been lower than the buyer's valuation, then she should have done that. And we want to somehow give her incentives to do that. Now, under the fault regime, again, sort of taking this from the tort analysis, we might imagine that if the breach is inadvertent, the seller pays no damages at all. So this is like the case where you cause an accident, but you took due care. It was just bad luck that the accident occurred. You don't pay damages in the tort setting, and similarly, the seller wouldn't pay damages in the contract setting. But then there's the case where you breach, and it's negligent or willful. And here, I'm just going to assume that the damages will be something higher than the buyer's equal to or greater than the buyer's valuation. So I'm not addressing the issue that a number of you address about whether damages should be super high in the case of a willful breach, as opposed to, let's say, a negligent breach or an inadvertent breach. I'm just going to assume that it's high. It's sort of arbitrarily high in both cases. And that's like similar in the tort analysis, where the damages don't really matter in the negligence regime as long as they're high enough to compensate the victim's loss. And then the analysis is very simple. It follows the tort analysis, and it's really not that different from the traditional analysis of damages. In fact, you could just reinterpret that model to say that the case where it's optimal to have zero damages is like the case where you have no liability because the breach was inadvertent rather than negligent. So, a little more formally, with respect to the performer breach decision, we want the seller to perform if her cost is less than the buyer's valuation. Well, under the negligence regime, if her cost is less than the buyer's valuation and she breaches, she has to pay a huge amount to the buyer, so she'll perform. That's the efficient performance decision. And then going back to the investment decision, again, just like in the tort context, since the seller is going to have to pay a lot if she breaches. I'm sorry. And then also under the negligence regime, the seller will have to pay damages if her cost is greater than the buyer's valuation if she failed to take cost-justified precautions, right? So that's the additional point. And so then going back to the investment stage, the seller's going to think, well, I don't want that to happen, so I'll take cost-justified precautions in order to prevent that from happening. So you get the same outcomes along these two dimensions. What are the differences between the two rules then? Well, there are actually two differences. The first is administrative, and many people have pointed this out, that under the negligence regime, the court has to have more information than it needs under the strict liability regime. Under the strict liability regime, all that the court needs to know is the buyer's valuation, and then the court sets damages equal to the buyer's valuation, or the buyer's valuation minus the unpaid price. it doesn't have to figure out, you know, what the seller's cost is or what the optimal investment should have been. Whereas under the negligence regime, the court does, right? And people have made exactly the same point about tort law. Tort law requires more information. Negligence requires more information on the part of the court than strict liability does. So with respect to administrative costs, the strict liability rule in contract law is superior to the negligence rule. But there's another difference that favors the negligence rule. This is a little more complicated. But the basic argument here is that if the strict liability regime is used, that essentially forces the breacher to insure the victim of breach ex ante, which will then be passed along in the form of a higher price to the victim of the breach. And so the point here is that, I mean, basically you think of the contract as just a joint venture, and ex ante, it's optimal for the parties if the promisor makes the efficient investment and then performs when the valuation is greater than the cost. That's fine. So that's fine. And if the parties, you know, had perfect information and designed every aspect of their contract, that's all that they would say. There's no reason for them to say that if the bad state of the world occurs, despite the fact that the seller took cost-justified precautions, the seller should make a payment to the buyer. Okay, that's like an insurance payment. And so the seller, in order to compensate herself ex ante, will demand a higher price from the buyer, which is conceptually the same as having a separate insurance transaction between the buyer and the seller. But there's no reason to think that the parties generally would want to enter that extra insurance transaction. Generally speaking, at least in commercial transactions, we probably assume the parties are risk neutral. But there's no particular reason to think that, let's say, in my example, the buyer is risk averse and the seller is risk preferring or risk neutral. So that's the advantage of negligence. In fact, if we use negligence, prices should be lower because they could avoid either these unnecessary insurance contracts or the transaction costs that are necessary to get around them. So that's the trade-off. It's hard to say in the abstract whether it follows that a negligence regime would be superior to a strict liability regime. There are advantages and disadvantages to both, which makes me think that the reason why tort law seems to be mainly negligence and contract law seems to be mainly strict liability may just be a historical accident. There are these two paradigms, and you could be in either one, and it probably doesn't matter that much. And I've been trying to learn a little bit about the civil law system, and I guess there's some experts here who can explain it better than I can. But my impression from talking to civil lawyers is that, in fact, in Europe, or at least in various countries, civil law countries, there is something like a fault regime for contract law. Their economies function fine, which further strengthens my conviction that it probably doesn't matter that much which system you have. Although, as is always the case when you talk to lawyers, there's so many exceptions and you're never really sure what the actual rule is. And I'm told that in Germany, although there's a fault rule, when you breach, there's this presumption that you're at fault. So it may, in the end, turn out to be a lot like strict liability. So I don't know. I'll let experts talk about that. So I have about 2 minutes left. I don't want to run through all the doctrines. I think other people will do this better than I will. But maybe just to get some of these on the table so that people can come back to them. There are a lot of doctrines in contract law. So the one thing I want to say is I'm not claiming that it turns out that contract law is actually a negligence regime. If once you read all the cases carefully, that's suddenly obvious. I don't think that's the case. I think it's predominantly a strict liability regime. But I'm making a much more modest point, which is that if I'm right that the fault system is just as good or no worse than the strict liability system, or that it's hard to tell them apart, it would be surprising if you didn't find pockets of fault in contract law, or if you didn't find courts every once in a while using fault-like notions in contract law, just as we find pockets of strict liability in tort law. And in fact, We do. And other people have made these points from time to time, I think. But certainly, but a lot, of course, depends on how you interpret these doctrines and, you know, what courts are really doing. So when you look at something like the impossibility or the impracticability doctrine, when I read these cases and when I teach them, I often get the sense that what the courts are really doing is trying to figure out not whether it was literally impossible to perform, you know, and sometimes, you know, whether the event was, you know, literally unforeseeable or extremely remote. They're not really trying to figure that out. They're just trying to figure out whether the promisor could have done something reasonable to prevent the breach. And if he could have, then the court is going to be less inclined to excuse him from liability. If he couldn't have, the court will be more likely to find that the impossibility or the impracticability doctrine applies. You see similar sorts of things, and Goetz and Scott and others have made this point, I think, roughly about good faith and best efforts. Sometimes when courts are I think probably it may be that the most important area of contract law where fault-like notions are introduced occurs when courts are interpreting ambiguous contracts. I think they often interpret ambiguous contracts to provide that, you know, the party should take cost-justified actions, not, you know, not that they have some kind of absolute obligation to act. And in the conditions cases, sometimes you see courts saying, okay, so this person breached, so the other person, at least formally, has the right to stop performing himself or not to pay. And you know, that's a really effective remedy, to not have to pay, even though somebody's built, you know, half built your building for you. And then the courts seem to say, well, we don't want to give that person such a powerful remedy if it turns out that the breach was inadvertent rather than willful or negligent. The person may still be able to sue for damages, but chances are they're not very high. So that's it for my 15 minutes, and I'd be happy to take questions. Ariel.
Three quick points. Now, the first one is that when you set your model, you are well aware of the problem of verifiability, right?
Of what? Verifiability.
Verifiability, right. So one of the problems with fault, as you are aware of, is that courts should have information about costs, benefits, and so on. And nevertheless, you argue in the rest of the papers the probability fault is better than strict liability. So it seems that at least implicitly, you assume that the verifiability problem is not such a problem at the end. And I wonder whether this is your opinion. And besides, when you give all the examples about positive law in which fault is taken into account, of course, there are many other doctrines in which fault is not taken into account. Mm-hmm. And my question would be then whether you think that in those situations, which are quite many, that fault is considered to be irrelevant, whether it is because of the verifiability. That's the first point. Now, the second question, which is shorter, it's about the victim, about the promisee's incentives. So I think that one of the advantages of having a fault regime, even without comparative and contributory negligence, right? Just a fault regime, comparing to strict liability, that it improves the incentives of the victim. Now, it seems that you do not acknowledge it in the paper, right? Because you say that there should be contributory negligence. But I think that even if you have, like in torts, right, there is the residual liability there is liability of the promisee for the residual harm, which improves its incentives. So the moral hazard problem that we have under strict liability is mitigated. Now the last point is it's also something that you discuss in the paper, and I think it's really interesting. Whether it's about the burden of proof, and you ask the question whether there should be a difference between torts, in which we know that the victim should prove the injurer's fault, comparing to contracts, and you've seen that actually it's a puzzle. You don't see any real reason why it should be different. And I would like to suggest that maybe it depends on the type of fault that we have in torts, comparing to the one that we have in contracts. But if torts, fault is not really fault in the moral way. Well, fault is more kind of an objective, kind of we have, of course, the hand formula, but occasionally it's a kind of a social norm that we should see whether the injurer complied with the social norm or not. Then you could have the burden of proof on the victim, while in contracts, maybe fault is more dependent, it should be tailored to the specific case, to the specific promisee, and then the promisee would probably have better information about it, and then we want to reverse the burden of proof.
Okay, yes, thanks. So on the first issue, I should be clear, I'm not arguing that fault is better, that I've proved that fault is better. I'd rather take the more modest stance that it's not really clear which system is better. So I simply acknowledge the verifiability problem. I'm not sure which other doctrines you have in mind. I mean, one possible theory, if you think that you know, this whatever system we have is optimal, and you want to rationalize the system we have, it may turn out that verifiability is such a serious problem that courts over the years have preferred strict liability. And it's not entirely clear to me, though, why that would be the true for contract law, not for torts. In fact, you'd think the opposite would be the case, that verifiability concerns would be less serious in contract law than in tort law, because the parties, knowing that the courts are concerned about this, can, you know, design their contracts better. Whereas in tort law, you know, there's no analogy to that. Your point about fault improving the incentives of the victims is correct, as far as I know, and the paragraph in the paper which says otherwise is incorrect. And then finally, on the burden of proof, I'm just not sure. This seems like a rule standards issue. Off the top of my head, I don't see any reason to think that fault is in some sense more objective in torts cases than contracts cases. But it seems to me that if you're right, that should be reflected in rules and standards rather than in the burden of proof. Saul?
Let me hazard a constructive view about why you keep teaching contracts as well. So there's another margin, some of the papers come close to this. There's another margin in contract law, and that's how we feel about specific performance versus expectancy damages. Mm-hmm. And again, whenever we think we have a specific performance system, or whatever countries have that, they have pockets of damages. Whenever we have a damages system, there are pockets of specific performance. Again, there's a whole literature on which is better, is one better, is it not, do they converge, you sort of feel like if you go to Mars, they might have the whole thing exactly backwards.
Right.
Well, it does occur to me, listening to you, that it might not be so easy to have that margin if instead of having expectancy damages, we had a fault-based system. I mean, if it was, we're not sure between specific performance, which has its pluses, and a fault-based system, there'd be a bigger gap between the two. And we might spend a lot of unnecessary effort either litigating or categorizing between those two. And so if you think specific performance for transactions caused or verifiability or other reasons is a good idea for some pockets, it might be that it's better partner is a strict liability damages system rather than a fault damages system.
Specific performance. I would think specific performance is better partner would be the fault system. Is that what you're saying?
No, the other way around. Because it's a closer... strict liability, because if you say to me, you breached that contract, there'll be specific performance, or you breached that contract, there'll be strict liability, that's pretty close. I can call you on the phone and bargain, and we can figure out whether I want to breach or not. They're really pretty close in terms of my net outlays to avoid breach or to breach and pay or whatever. But if it's specific performance or fault, there's sort of a bigger discontinuity between the two. And I will spend more time arguing, maybe I will get to be in the fault category. In that case, I don't want to bargain with you as much about the specific performance rule and so forth.
No, I thought you were saying the opposite, because what I thought was an interesting...
Let me say whichever is better.
I thought this was an interesting point, which is that if you have the fault system, it doesn't matter as much whether you have specific performance or expectation damages. In fact, specific performance would be fine with the fault system. The disadvantage that it normally has, that it prevents efficient breach, would not be a disadvantage in the fault system, because presumably specific performance would not be ordered. So I would think, maybe that's what's going on in Germany,
right? That's
for the
opposite, right?
I kind of like that idea. All right, so the opposite.
From the breacher's point of view, you want to breach, you might not care whether specific performance or strict liability is the rule with respect to you.
So you're talking about the renegotiation?
Yeah.
Okay. So.
But I see your point.
All right. So. You're arguing that at the stage of renegotiation, which I assumed away, so everybody knows that the promisor is breached and the promisor wants to breach, and the promisor wants to pay the victim to release him. which system would be better? Well, the fault system would allow you to, well, I mean, both fault, the fault system, no matter what, and the strict liability system with damages would reduce renegotiation costs.
But right. The latter would be closer to specific performance.
Eric, I think that my answer to Saul would be that under your theory, if it's a fault regime, then when there is no fault, there is no specific performance by definition. And then you don't have this gap.
If there's no fault.
Yeah, if there's no fault, there's no specific performance.
Right, that's what I'm assuming.
That's giving away a lot. Yeah. Then that might take away a lot of the advantages of specific performance because of assessment, verifiability, and a lot of other
things. That was why I answered your question. Okay.
So you said in also in the paper in the talk that you're kind of agnostic about the measure of damages. It could be equal to evaluation or higher, and you're not getting into that point. And that seems it seemed initially reasonable because we know that when we have negligence, the measure of damages is not that important. But then I was looking at your model, and it seems to me that it does play a role, and you do need to. You know, just to get technical detail, you do have to assume D equals V in order to get a precise condition for the ex ante care level. And I was wondering why that is. And my thought, and just tell me if I'm wrong or on this, is that in your model, the damages will be imposed, or let me put it differently, will not be imposed if you take an inadequate level of care, but then it turns out to be, you know, TL. So maybe you. Maybe it is assumed away in kind of the simple version of this, but maybe this is it's a kind of a hybrid in this sense. So it's not as if whenever you take an inadequate level of care, you're automatically you have these large damages imposed on you. You can it depends on the realization, and therefore it just seems.
Right. So I need to think about that more. I don't want to stand up here and think aloud too much, but. So I think your point is that if the bad state of the world occurs, so it's proper for the seller to breach, in that case he'll pay damages, right? And you're saying if D is greater than V, he'll pay damages, let's call it 2V. And so when he's making his investment at the earlier stage, he will assume that the amount that he wants to avoid by making the investment would be higher than it would be if it were just V, which maybe is too high. That's your point.
I think it might even work the other way around for you as well. So if we have, just tell me if I'm getting your definition of fault or this regime correctly. So what happens if I took the X in your model? I took it, it was too low. Did not invest enough, but then the realization was okay, so it was still CL. Mm-hmm. Then you would not impose any damages. Am I correct? Under your assumption?
No. You want to. You have to engage in the level. The goal is to engage in a level of investment that minimizes the probability. The probability of the bad state of the world.
Right, but even if you take low investment, there's a chance that the good, that you will still have a low cost, right? It will be lower probability that you will have a low cost, higher probability that you will have a high cost. There's still a probability that you'll see a low cost and then perform.
Right.
In this case, you would impose no damages.
Right.
So this is not a standard kind of negligence type regime. Whenever X is too low, hit you big.
Okay, I'll have to think about it. I understood your first point. I'm not sure I understand the second, but with respect to the first point, maybe I got something wrong there. It may be that it does have to be V, which would then be another strike against the negligence regime on the administrative cost side. But I'll just go back and then look. Richard?
I'm curious as to why it is that the major difference between contracts and tort is not mentioned here, which is the freedom of contract. Essentially, in the contract area, you can roll your own in whatever form you see. And if you actually look at the way in which they are rolled, typically, they never take the form which you put in the paper. And even with the strict liability system, they often don't take that form because they will often stipulate liquidated damages. They will have various kinds of default measures of one kind or another. And so why is it the proper solution to say we're trying to find default terms? And if in fact we see a huge variety of different kinds of contractual arrangements in different sorts of settings on both liability and damages, that the only thing that we can be confident about is that both of these models are probably of most highly restricted application and are wrong in many cases. Because remember, the parties have all the incentives to do all the optimization that you want. And if you have a typical kind of liquidated damage clause or a buyout clause or a milestone provision or a forfeiture clause and so forth, it seems to me that your theory has to account for them in addition to only sort of stipulating these two kinds of cases for rules which are actually relatively infrequent. The negligence one is almost never seen except in kinds of malpractice type cases, and the strict liability rule is often accompanied with very stringent limitations, for example, on consequential damages.
Well, with respect to, you know, freedom of contract, to the extent that the parties, you know, design their contracts and courts enforce them, and that's the end of the, you know, that's fine. The paper's really not about that at all. It's about
98% of the cases.
Yeah, it is, but the literature, the entire, you know, the expectation damages literature, you can say the same thing. It's not about, well, I mean, I sympathize with that view. You know, you could say the same thing about the, I mean, the funny thing about the contract literature is that, well, 98% of it is that part of it, you know, is extremely simple. If the parties, you know, agree to a bunch of terms, and it's clear that the state of the world that results is anticipated by those terms, the optimal thing for the court to do is simply to enforce the terms. And there's nothing more to say about this. The literature only arises for the situations, which may well be a substantial portion, certainly of the litigated cases. The situations where the parties did not clearly anticipate the events that gave rise to the dispute. And that, you know, at this point, the courts have to intervene in some way. They have to say, we're going to interpret these terms in a certain way, or we're going to, you know, give you the impossibility excuse or something like that. And the freedom of contract sort of model doesn't work for that, because it's assumed that the parties did not write into their contract the events that actually occurred because the transaction costs were too high. And that's very tort-like, because transaction costs are just a kind of precaution. I mean, writing into the contract is just another type of precaution that the parties take in order to ensure that a dispute won't arise or that the party's obligations are proper. And the failure to do so is what requires some kind of judicial intervention. And this is just the default rules literature. So the judicial intervention is in the form of default rules that will, one hopes, give the parties the proper incentives either to draft the contract or to take precautions or to perform or breach. And that is very tort-like, because even though these parties are voluntarily dealing with each other, they're unable, because of transaction costs and the difficulty of predicting the future, to actually make arrangements for what could very well happen. I think that's how the entire literature works.
I think that's wrong too.
Why?
For example, you take many cases in partnerships. What people will do is they'll draft the various scales of agreement and will consciously rely on the default provisions that are contained in a uniform code of one sort or another. And it's a transactions cost argument only to the extent that we have this wonderful template out there,
right,
and we're willing to use it.
Right.
And if that template bears no relationship to anything in this model, then the model is wrong, notwithstanding the fact that we're talking about a situation.
Well, the template could be wrong. They rely on the template when they draft their contract, and the entire question is just whether the template is right or wrong.
Well, but I mean, you know, most of these templates work in a different way from yours. What you do is you look at the observed contract, and then you sort of assume that unless there's some reason to believe that the ones in which these clauses are not specified are radically different from the ones in which they are, the distributions that you see on liability, benefit, fault, contributory negligence, or whatever it is, ought to be about the same thing. And so if that's the method that you're doing it, it's an imitation method, and it's not a sort of a deductive method based upon a model. And I think the reason why we prefer the imitative method is...
The what method? I'm sorry.
You imitate the contracts you observe. So, for example, the UCC, in my judgment, is clearly wrong when its presumption is against the limitation on consequential damages when these things are uniformly specified. And that what you want to do is to have the imitation strategy rather than the first deduction strategy.
You may well be right. That is, when it comes down to drafting codes or courts trying to figure out, you know, what the default terms would be, it may well be a better strategy for courts to look at what parties do when they do anticipate the sorts of problems that the parties before the courts fail to anticipate. I don't have any problem with that view. So in the case of the Uniform Commercial Code, just to take your example, you know, one reason to criticize the limitations on consequential damages is that, you know, we're sort of Burkeans and we look around and we say, you know, basically people don't like those limitations. So there's no reason for the code to provide this default, which just creates transaction costs. You know, that's fine. I'm a little skeptical about how well one can do that, but if one can do that, yeah, that's probably a better way of gathering information about optimal rules than this kind of deductive exercise. I agree with that. Dick.
Yeah, I like the paper. Let me push you a little more on the definition of fault, though. I think we've got, what, 13 papers for this conference.
Yes, might as well start here.
13 definitions of fault. So let's think about it in connection with the impracticability cases that you discussed, where, as you say, courts often do seem to be looking at the two parties and figuring out what, if anything, they could have done. But there's two different ways that might be relevant. In fact, in torts, it's really the distinction between standard negligence, all of the learned hand formula, and something like Guido Calabresi's best cost avoider. But it's sometimes, as in the learned hand formula, we look and see what the parties could have done to see if there was something they should have done and didn't. Whereas the best cost avoider notion is a little harder to pin down exactly. In fact, George Cohen has written nicely about this. But the best cost avoider notion is sort of like looking at who is in a better position to decide what to do, whether or not they made the right decision. Well, when you look at the cases in impracticability, you think the courts are more doing the first or more doing the second, or sometimes doing one and sometimes doing the other, or?
Well, I don't understand the best cost avoider either. So one possibility is they're engaging in sort of hand formula style. And that in the paper, I'm...
There certainly are some cases that
I think they are in some cases. So, but, you know, you never really know what these courts are thinking, and this is a non, you know, and obviously the data set from which I selected these cases was the first year case book, so not a representative sample. I did actually do some searches for fault in Westlaw and found a few other cases. But so one possibility is they're doing the hand formula. This is not the usual interpretation of what's going on. For example, if you read the restatement, although the restatement has some notes which sort of gestures in this direction. So what else could they be doing? Okay, so one possibility is they're trying to distinguish events that are hard to foresee from events that are not hard to foresee. That's in the doctrine. Courts are often saying that, right? I'm skeptical about that. I think you've written about this. Lots of people have written about this. Just because, of course, the relevant question of foreseeability is just whether the seller's costs rise, and it's really relevant to the parties whether, you know, it's the result of the Suez Canal closing or of a strike in the seller's plant. So. And then, of course, you know, at one point, the courts meant literal impossibility, but that must have seemed silly to them from the beginning. There's no distinction between literal impossibility. There's no relative normative distinction between literal impossibility and, you know, the costs are so high, but not quite infinity. So, you know, what are they doing? It may be that they're acting in a kind of an arbitrary way. It may be that, as some people have argued, that they're sort of providing an insurance function of some sort, so maybe we're talking about events that, whether or not they're foreseeable, you couldn't have taken precautions against. But, you know, that just begins to sound like the hand formula again. So I guess part of what's going on here is we need to provide an account for all of these cases where courts do not award liability. And I think, at least from a law and economics perspective, the negligence account is one that is coherent. So here's another possibility, which is what I thought you were about to say, which is at least one view of negligence liability in tort law is it's some kind of objective, you know, standard of what the reasonable person would do. It's not put in economic terms. And economists may want to try to put that in economic terms, but it might have some other content. Maybe it's sort of like what Richard has said, you look around and see how most people act. So maybe that's what's really going on in these cases. But I find it hard to come up with a coherent alternative account for why courts are excusing liability in these cases.
We can talk later about the best cost of labor.
Okay.
I was wondering, when it comes to the transplant of the notion of fault from tort to contract, what would be your position concerning the role of reliance? Because it seems to me that the role of reliance in the notion of fault or negligence in tort law has that, if at all in this country, less relevance or different relevance from the one in the contract. And so when it comes to the promises, reliance, and the investments that are made, you might have some difficulty to apply the negligence notion that has been developed in the tort theory.
The promisee's reliance. So the question is whether, so in this model, the question is whether the promisor could have taken a precaution that was cost-justified, would have reduced the risk of the bad state of the world. And your question is about whether the promisee could have taken a precaution, which is not in this model, is that
not
right?
Sure,
so as to minimize his reliance.
Reliance, I think, is slightly different from precaution. It is the extent to which, when it comes to the cost that the seller has to face, the level of reliance of the promisee should be taken into account, which is not the case in tort law, when the level of reliance of the victim and the possibility that the injurer will cause damage is not taken into account.
Well, I think it's the same, because in the hand formula, you're supposed to take into account the loss on the that you impose on the victim, and in this setting, the seller or the promisor is supposed to take into account the loss that he imposes on the buyer, which you could call reliance cost if you want. Now it's a little bit different, of course, because in the tort setting, the third party is unknown and involuntarily a victim, but in the contract setting, I think it amounts to the same thing, which is that. Sure, the parties could have anticipated it, but the fact is that the buyer's loss, what is his loss exactly? It's not a reliance loss in the doctrinal sense. That is to say, he built foundations for the machines that the seller was supposed to deliver. What we're concerned about is the buyer's valuation, which would be what he gets out of the entire contract. But that's the traditional measure of damages as well. The expectation damages is based on the buyer's valuation, not based on simply the reliance cost that the buyer incurred in anticipation of performance. Yes?
What do we do under the efficient breach formula with restitution? I mean, it seems like you say that seller pays damages only if the breach was willful or negligent. But if your measure of damages is restitution, it seems like that's always going to be efficient. You pay back whatever it was that the other party gave you, and then you efficiently breach the contract. So I'm wondering whether this formulation ever allows the, call it the injured party to get back whatever cash they gave over to the other party.
Well, restitution is used in different ways. So, one way it could be used is just to say that the buyer in this situation would be able to obtain from the seller whatever advantage the seller tried to obtain by breaching. So it would be P minus C, I guess. And if conceptually the same, analytically the same as specific performance, as the seller will never breach if the buyer has that type of restitution remedy. And so people who have written about this just treat restitution as basically the same as specific performance. Is that wrong? People say?
They do it, but they're
close enough.
Pardon me?
Close enough.
So now typically the way restitution damages are actually awarded in contracts cases is not like that. You might have, that situation might arise if the breach occurs because the seller resells the product to some third party and makes a lot of money off. And that might go to the buyer. And if that's the case, the seller is not going to breach also. In the situation which I use in the paper, I'm not sure that a court would award restitution. It's hard to imagine a court awarding restitution in that case. And then there are a lot of these sort of strange cases in contract law where courts award restitution in a way that seems to be unrelated to the function of the contract, what the parties are trying to accomplish. And when courts do this, then it's just sort of arbitrary. So like in the losing contract case where even though the party did you a favor by breaching, you might be able to obtain restitution from them because you've performed a little bit. You know, that just sort of undermines the contract and doesn't make any sense, you know, whatever economic approach you might take.
Okay. Eric, do you want to take another question? Just spend a minute or two wrapping this up.
Sure. I don't need to wrap it up.
A quick note on impracticability. Andrew Call has a fabulous article where he looks at all the cases and decides that courts aren't using any sort of min formula. They're not thinking about lowest cost avoiders, but rather what they're consistently refusing to do is shift the real costs that are imposed by the event from one party to another. So the unexpected event occurs, it imposes real costs on either the plaintiff or the defendant. What the courts never do is shift those costs to the other parties. In other words, they just sit back and do nothing. That's sort of the theory. We're not in a position to reconfigure the contract.
Yeah, but the question is why the courts intervene in some cases. When you talk about it that way, that's just talking about the remedy, which is against the baseline where we're expecting the breacher to have to pay expectation damages. All that's happening is that the breacher doesn't have to pay anything at all, which is the negligence outcome, right? That is, it's the outcome that it's the remedy that the non-remedy that you have to pay if it turns out that you're not negligent. So that's not the key issue. The key issue is why is it that courts sometimes excuse people under the impracticability doctrine and sometimes fail to excuse people under the impracticability doctrine? And that's what you need some theory about what the rule is. Just the fact that the seller doesn't have to pay doesn't tell us what that theory is.
And that's a quick follow-up. Yeah. I was wondering why your answer, Richard, can't just think about freedom of contract, because contract law restrains the sorts of remedies that parties might otherwise agree to impose on each other. In other words, you can't contract any punitive damage, you can't contract any injunctions. I'm wondering if your model doesn't actually help us think about whether those restrictions are just a model.
I don't think My approach helps much. Those are more difficult, I think, questions. What I will say, going back to Richard's point, is one of the odd things about the economic literature is it often does seem to justify ignoring what the party's intentions are. So the whole justification for expectation damages has always seemed to me that to be doing precisely that. The parties say we want this guy to perform. The courts say he has an option instead. Parties didn't give him an option. The parties just say perform, and so either the courts are ignoring the terms of the contract, or they're just interpreting the contract to say that, most of the time when people say perform, they don't really mean that. They mean perform if it's efficient, and pay damages otherwise. And I think really the clue in thinking about this, the key to finding more evidence of fault ideas in contract law is not in the doctrines where we've all been looking at so far, like the impracticability doctrine or the good faith doctrine, but is in actually how the courts interpret the contracts. So the courts have a tremendous amount of leeway to interpret these contracts. I think they're rarely literalistic about them. And I think that when they interpret these contracts, they say, well, what would sensible business people want to do in this situation when there's an ambiguity? And they would probably think, sensible business people would want each side to make cost-justified investments, not to make, to over-invest in the contract. So I think that would be the best place to look for more evidence of fault.
Perfect. Thanks a lot.
This audio file is a production of the University of Chicago Law School. Visit us on the web at www.law.uchicago.edu.